coming to you from the City of the Weird. Exploring topics from the esoteric and unexplored to dimensions unknown. Shining a light of truth on the darkest corners of our reality. Welcome to the Curious Realm. Well, hello, everybody, and welcome to this very special pre-recorded episode of The Curious Realm. I am out on the road right now, presently. At this point, I am on a cruise with a bunch of remote viewers, so we will be bringing you the upcoming coverage from the remote viewing 25th anniversary cruise coming up soon. But our guest in this segment is the amazing Lyle Blackburn. He has a new book, The Lake Worth Monster, the true story of the Greer Island Goat Man. And this is a very interesting story that happened up near, up at Lake Worth in the Fort Worth area. So welcome back to the show, our good friend Lyle Blackburn. How are you doing?
I'm good.
We had you on not too long ago, actually, while we were out at a conference and mentioned the Goat Man. And this is quite an interesting case, actually. The case of the Lake Worth Monster is one of those cryptid sightings that, as opposed to just having a sighting or two, was actively a mass sighting by a bunch of people at one point. So there have been numerous sightings over the years. Let's get into a little bit of the history of the Lake Worth Monster, Lyle.
Yeah, it is an interesting one because in some cases the alleged creature was seen by upwards of 40 people at one time. So you don't usually get that in a cryptid case. But yeah. Essentially the gist of this was that on July 10th, 1969, a couple was out at Lake Worth at a place called Greer Island. And Lake Worth is north of Fort Worth. And at that time in 1969, it was sort of a lover's lane hangout, a place where people went fishing and just got out on the lake. And it was like dirt roads. It wasn't heavily populated out there around that area as it is now. And so the couple was out there and there was a couple of other cars with couples in them. And the man, John Reichert, was down fishing, and this was after dark. He was doing some night fishing, and his wife was a little spooked, so she just stayed up in the car and I guess had a flashlight or something, was reading a book. And all of a sudden, John hears his wife, Linda, scream, and he turns around and looks, and there's some sort of a whitish figure that came up, down on the hood and kind of shifted down towards the passenger side window. And, you know, she's screaming, and all of a sudden, he just throws his fishing pole down and runs up there and tussles with what he described as a tall, hairy goat man type thing covered in white hair. It had horns, and he basically gets in the car, and they speed off and drive up to a cafe where they call the police, and the police respond. By then, the other couples who were down there who had also seen this arrived at the cafe, and they proceeded to tell the police that some sort of monster attacked them down there at Greer Island. So the police were a bit dubious, of course, but he had John showed them a big scratch down the side of the car where it appeared something had happened, and they were all freaked out. So the police went down there, and of course they didn't find any trace of the alleged monster at the time. However, the police had received calls for about 2 months prior to that of people reporting some kind of strange thing going on. And then, so that got printed in the Fort Worth Star-Telegram, and that kind of made it an instant big deal. That was viral back then, 1969. It's in the paper, monster attacks couple. Then the very next night, there were numerous people out there assembled at the area around Greer Island. And that evening, they all witnessed something, some some bipedal something run up on this ridge above this meadow, and it ran back and forth and then allegedly threw a tire with the wheel, like, over the heads of the astounded onlookers, which included police officers. Everybody scattered and ran, and it was a big deal. And that got printed in the newspaper, and that's what cemented this thing in the local lore immediately. And then from then on, there were various sightings of all sorts. There were some photos taken, kind of a famous photo, and in my book even has another photo that nobody's ever seen of the alleged creature. And all this went down over the next course of the next year or two with more sightings. A woman wrote a book, and that just sort of ingrained this Lake Worth monster in sort of the Texas cryptid legends, and certainly around here. And I grew up about 25 minutes away from Lake Worth. I was born in Fort Worth, so it's kind of a hometown thing to me in a way.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's our Fort Worth Star Telegram still runs articles on this every once in a while. There's a Lake Worth monster bash that happens every so often. So it's something that was near and dear to me as far as a monster case, and something that eventually it almost compelled me. I needed to write this book.
Well, and the book is fantastic. It's got tons of pictures in it. How many sightings have there been since the original? I guess you would call it a flap originally. You know, there being a few sightings right there, right next to each other, and especially the one very large sighting, which, once again, even in the world of any paranormal or UFO sighting, it's pretty rare to have a mass sighting of like 40 plus people seeing something or having an experience at the same time. So,
oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, your typical Bigfoot encounter or goat man or whatever you want to, lake monster, you know, if you've got more than one person, two or three, that's usually an exceptional sighting. But yeah, here you have 40 people claiming to see something, which just fueled that fire, obviously. And WBAP News was down there interviewing people. So this was being broadcast on the television stations, local Channel 5 or whatever. And, you know, back then, of course, you know, you only had a few stations. You had one major newspaper. So, you know, everybody's reading about this. You know, pre-internet, and this is, you know, the summer of love, 1969, you know, while hippies are doing whatever they're doing in California, here in Texas, we're fighting monsters.
Well, you know, once again, a very ingrained case here in Texas of a very large sighting. How many there, even when it comes to the description of the goat man, I guess, and that's one of the questions, is goat man or Bigfoot? You know, it's been described by many people as being much more, I guess, Sasquatch-esque, but the description was hair like a goat. And I guess that's where the goat man moniker comes from. But, why the confusion between the two, Lyle?
Yeah, that's one of the big questions. I mean, it's one of those, it's just not a clear cut case of even what people were actually seeing. And following that initial flap of in July, I would say there was a good, I don't know, 20 or 30 sightings in and around that next year. And there, the picture that was taken, a sort of famous one. There again, this is 1969, and you don't have a lot of alleged cryptid photos or videos from that far back. You got Patterson-Gimlin film from 67, but I mean, here we are in Texas, and you know, even though it's sort of that typical blurry photo, it's still something. And that was taken with a Polaroid instant camera, you know, the ones that spit out the film. I mean, this was a miraculous that the guy even got the photo in time and was even that much in focus, I suppose. But yeah, people, the original witnesses, the Reichertz, described it as a goat man, and he claimed to have seen horns on the head. Now, pretty much all the subsequent sightings described it more in terms of a ape-like thing walking on two legs, though, yes, it was covered in white hair, which is, I mean, Bigfoot witnesses have reported, you know, hair colors ranging from dark black to brown to red, blonde, yeah, silver and white. So it's an interesting case where it sort of gets lumped in with the goat man category, which in my mind, a lot of that falls into urban legend. If you start looking at goat man legends versus, you know, just a solid Bigfoot sighting that's sort of documented and some people saw something, it's somewhere in between that, though. I think the bottom line is some people saw some sort of unexplainable thing, and that is what, you know, what the appeal is, that it's unsolved and really never could quite,
yeah,
you know, pin it down as to what it was. But at the bottom line, it was an exceptional case where people saw something.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And you know, one of those true moments where observation begins the process, because once again, once you have that many people, including officers of the law, it wasn't just a rabble of random people. There were police officers that were present in that rabble, all kinds of things. So yeah, pretty interesting to see how the media handled that case and really kind of shot it into the public eye.
Yeah. Yeah. So that, you know, that kind of made it memorable for whatever, you know, was to come with cryptid research and everything else. And it, you know, was adopted kind of kept alive by Bigfoot researchers, you know, was often included in Bigfoot books and things like that. So that kept it alive prior to just sort of the more general paranormal stuff that we see like on the internet and podcasts. There's a lot more paranormal things now, but back then it was either UFOs or it was,
yeah,
you know, Bigfoot. There was a lot of in between. And so, you know, of course there was all sorts of rumors that it was a hoax and this person did this and the police believed it was some kids, and you know, the wildlife officials there around in and around this Greer Island refuge, you know, they said, well, there's a bobcat loose around here in the woods and it's probably a bobcat, and you know, all these wild explanations for what it was. But when you look at it, it's like none of those really explain the whole thing, you know, and in the end, it's just a fascinating, you know, phenomenon of people in modern times claiming to see monsters. And that's the fascinating part of the story. And I just go where the information leads. I mean, and I present, here's the sightings, here's the circumstances, here's all the rumors of the hoaxes and what people said. And then in the end, it's sort of like we're still left with this unsolved mystery, and the reader can follow along and make their own judgments from there. But this has everything that's ever been documented on the case, as well as new things that I discovered in my research, as well as first person things. I was able to talk to the son of John Reichert. No one's ever interviewed any of the Reichert's subsequent to the news article. Now, John's passed away, but his son remembers this vividly.
Wow.
Got that. Other people who were there at the time, a late friend of mine, Bill Morris, which I met more than a decade ago, he was there the night the whole thing went down with a tire toss and everything else. So I've got this as best you can get first person information that hasn't really been put together in any form and with the complete story. Because if you look on the internet, you know, you see a smattering of this and the original newspaper articles, and somebody says there's a couple of sightings and then there's a photo. Well, there's a whole lot more to it than that.
And what did Reichard's son have to say about things?
Well, first off, when he found out that this was even a thing nowadays, he was amazed. He wasn't in the loop on sort of the longevity of this story. And because his father's name had been printed in the newspaper and even his address, can you imagine that now?
Yeah, yeah. Back in the day where,
it's just nutty. But his name was prominent in this case, and that, like I said, Bigfoot researchers and other sort of paranormal with the Goatman aspect, he was amazed that this was something that people talked about. So once he actually got in contact with our buddy Craig Woolheater, who's a prominent cryptid researcher and Bigfoot guy here in Texas, and then Craig put Eric in contact with me. So I interviewed him, and he said he remembers his dad. He didn't like to talk about the story because everybody laughed at it, but he was like, I saw this. Your mother saw this. I don't know what it was, but this happened. And Eric recalled that his father had done a sketch of the creature.
Oh, wow.
Now, as cryptid luck goes, the sketch was, and I kid you not, was like buried underground or something, and was dug up and then lost, and then some crazy story. But Eric's like, I remember the drawing. I remember. So I had my good friend Jonathan Dodd, who did all the artwork for my book. I said, Jonathan, you talk to Eric and you recreate whatever the heck the drawing is, whatever Eric remembers. So we recreate that, and it's a very quite monstrous goat man looking thing, not a Bigfoot at all.
Interesting.
And that's in the book. So that's what Eric remembered, and what I was able to get as far as a perspective of what his dad's story really was beyond just what's printed in the news.
Now, when it comes to that, when it comes to goat man cryptids, what other cases do we have like that? Are there anything else in Texas that we could possibly tie that to, or any other cases outside of Texas that have similar sightings?
Yeah, you know, and that's one thing I kind of tried to do, is I had to look at it from both angles, from, you know, goat man, what is it? Is it a so-called goat man or is it Bigfoot? And I had to look at other tie-ins or similar cases to kind of say, what are the other similarities? So as far as goat man lore, you have just in Texas, you have Old Alton Bridge, which is located near Denton in North Texas, not far from Lake Worth, which has a legend of a more traditional goat man, if you will. And goat men are usually associated with bridges. And so in this case, it seems a little more paranormal, where people see this goat man who is sort of the spirit of this man who was hung from the bridge. That's sort of the origin story. So you have that. And then probably the most famous goat man in terms of cryptids is the Maryland goat man. And in Maryland, in an area up there in Prince George's County, there's a long history of people reporting sightings of a goat man-like entity of some sort, which is also slightly associated with bridges. So I kind of look at that, and also a creature called the Popelik monster, which is from Popelik, Kentucky, and it's said to haunt this train trestle out there. So I kind of compared and contrasted those, which are fascinating stories unto themselves. And just look at the similarities. And of course, these kind of go even further back, and with an origin of sort of mythological creatures like Pan, a satyr.
Yeah.
And it's a really fascinating thing. I mean, you could really go off in other directions with this whole thing, with the evolution of creatures, human-like creatures, humanoids that were said to have goat characteristics, and that can represent sort of a wild, out of control, primitive, wild, feral sort of, aspect to these things. So there's a lot of connections here with not just cryptozoology and people saying they saw a creature or a Bigfoot, but also this sort of ingrained cultural phenomenon of us seeing goat creatures and related possibly to what originated as, mythological creatures originally.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, especially whenever you start looking, I've got three billy goats gruff up right now. Yeah. Whenever you start looking at fairy tales like that, those kind of stories that came over with old settlers from Germany, that kind of stuff. I could absolutely see how those get woven into their local paranormal phenomena.
And there seems to be something that can be associated, a paranormal association with bridges. There's something about bridges is almost like a hot spot of weird things. When I was growing up, and I'm not far from Lake Worth, but there was a story of a bridge out here called Screaming Bridge. And supposedly, somebody careened off the bridge and some kids died. And now when you go out there and you honk your horn or you turn out the lights, you can hear screaming from these ghostly figures. And obviously that's way more paranormal into the ghost realm, but it still has that association with a bridge, just like Old Alton Bridge has the goat man. And so it's just a real interesting crossover between urban legend and cryptids.
Well, and to begin with, there is a huge link with specifically running water and the paranormal. The fact that spirits can't cross over running water. Vampires can't cross over running water. Things like that. So the idea of a bridge being not only a bridge for people, but for the paranormal, a way by which these things can bypass that rule because now there's ground under their feet,
Right.
So, the idea that where you may be going there for safe haven, they can now use it as something else because you've created this pathway across that never existed before.
And it's just interesting how that you see these themes, consistent themes from different parts of the country, or even like you said, some of this has come over as far back as settlers. So you see these consistencies and things like that. And you just, do creatures haunt bridges or do bridges have a certain vibe that we then associate strange encounters with the bridge? But either way, it's that phenomenon I love of how these stories morph and change and become part of a new version of our culture and are still here. And in this case, where you had people who were adamant that they had seen a physical hairy creature in the woods, and someone even got a photo. Now, not to say it wasn't a hoax, but something was there.
Well, and if hoax, once again, hoaxed quite a few, trained law enforcement officers, who were probably pretty well. Most folk at that time, especially living out in the rural area, would have been pretty familiar with their hunting game in the area, things like that. I would tend to think most people working for the local sheriff's office would have a good idea of, game that they come across as roadkill, that kind of stuff. So, I don't think they would have been fully taken in by hoax. And not only that, but where is the vested interest in hoax at that point?
I mean, what was the end game? I mean, not to say that in some of these flaps that some people don't try to add to it. So you could definitely get a mix, but that doesn't mean to discredit, say, what John Reichert saw. You know, and you're right, the authorities, you know, there were, it wasn't just kids out there. There were all ages and all backgrounds. And I think if it was a bobcat or whatever, it would be easily discernible.
Yeah.
I even include a story in the book, which sort of says that they're not going to be fooled, you know, by just a common animal, because there was actually a case where a feral monkey was running around out there around Lake Worth.
Oh, wow.
And this was in the Fort Worth Star Telegram a good 10 years before the Lake Worth monster. So this was back in the late 50s. Real interesting, because the point was, is that there's weird stuff in the woods, even if it's a wild monkey, a primate, that there actually was, but they did not confuse it for a 7 foot tall Bigfoot or goat man like creature. It was simply, there's this feral monkey, and it had been seen by various residents, and they ended up, it started killing dogs and things. It was running amok, and they ended up having to shoot the thing. And so, yeah, there it is, 1959. And just, but the point being is, if you know, they did not confuse
that with the Lake Worth monster.
So I don't think that people are going, even worse, they're going to confuse a bobcat for an upright thing. It just doesn't add up.
Well, and also, I mean, at the point that the mass sighting happened, people were pretty well posse'd up at that point. It was pretty much like a, hey, this thing happened, let's all go out and confront this thing, you know?
Yeah.
That was kind of the vibe of it. It wasn't like a whole bunch of people were at a picnic and this randomly happened. Like, they went out searching for this thing when it had its, I guess what you would equate to almost a threat display of, you know, throwing the tire from the hilltop and all that kind of stuff. But they were actively out searching for it. It wasn't an accidental run across or something like that.
All right. Yeah. Especially after that, you know, you had amateur monster hunters, if you will, on the case, and they were actively looking, they were armed.
Yep.
And, you know, I have a picture in my book that probably no one's ever seen of Alan Plaster, who is the guy who took that most famous photo. And he's packing a sidearm, like a hefty looking gun. And that's in the book. And they were down there with guns. And of course, in all the cases, the police are more worried that, you know, somebody's going to get shot. They're not too worried about the monster being shot. It's the people, because you've got armed people. I mean, this is Texas, 1969. Like I said, it's like summer of love. What's that? We're down here with guns in the woods trying to shoot this monster.
That's
awesome.
Yeah. And it's once again, a very interesting story from a very localized community where a bunch of people went out on the hunt for this thing and actively ran across it. And I suppose to an extent ran afoul of it. How many, what has been the follow up on that, Lyle? Have there been a whole lot of sightings since? Are there sightings that get reported to you, with you being there locally, all that kind of stuff?
Well, you know, there was some scan activity that continued on into the 70s, and various weirdness going on at the lake. Then after that, you know, as the 80s and 90s, it really dies off, but you do have some, you know, I looked at residual sort of sightings or other Bigfoot sightings, and the Lake Worth was it's a reservoir of the West Fork of the Trinity River. So the Trinity River is a long river basin through Texas. So conceivably anything that would be along Lake Worth could have traveled up and down the rest of the river. So I do find other sightings, but Lake Worth itself has become increasingly more populated. It has, you know, grown up in that area, and certainly now it is just, you go there and yes. you just wouldn't imagine a cryptid sighting or flap in there, because there's just so much development. And although it's still preserved, that area is part of what's now the Fort Worth Nature Center, which used to be the Greer Island Wildlife Refuge. But essentially, it's luckily been designated as a nature preserve, and still is. So you can go visit that area. And in some ways, Greer Island still looks the same, at least in that area where it's part of the nature preserve. So that's maintained, but it's just everything around it is just sort of cut off, other than the actual river corridor. Everything else is really kind of grown up around it, where I'm not surprised that there's not continued sightings in there. It's just Dallas Fort Worth is huge and populated now, and most of your sightings that may have happened back in there from, well, back in the 30s on up to 69 and into the 70s, eventually sort of sightings have moved off to other more wooded areas and remote, like East Texas and the Piney Woods and things. So I don't really get reports, but if something weird does happen out there.
Well, and it is interesting, once again, that it ties into the Trinity River Basin, because I'm from the east side of Houston. Like, Trinity River runs all the way down to the Gulf of Mexico, you know? So it runs through the deep thicket. It runs through all of that. So the idea that if it's following that food line, that water line across things, then sure, it could be one of 100 cryptids or other animals that are roaming the area.
Right. And you do see that. It's there's some other interesting, and I kind of, this would be a little bit more covered in my Texas Bigfoot book, where I go, well, the whole state, but yeah, you know, if you follow the Trinity River, you've got Lake Worth Monster, you've got Chambers Creek Monster, you've gotten the Dayton Monkey Man, you've got all these sort of little regional cryptid legends that are in and around that, you know, the river path. And that's always interesting, where you kind of follow these.
Yeah.
They always follow the creeks, as they say in the Legend of Boggy Creek movie, that you can find other weird stuff up and down these waterways, which may or may not be related, but it just shows you that these waterways attract whatever it is that people are seeing.
Well, and let's start exploring that real quick in the last few minutes, Lyle. What other cryptids do we know of in the area? Like, what other sightings have there been in the local DFW area?
There's some interesting ones. White Rock Lake over in the Dallas area is known for, there's a giant catfish story, like this enormous, huge catfish that was supposedly in the lake, you know, and even some ghostly tales of the woman of White Rock Lake. I've interviewed a friend of ours, Jason McLean, who had a sighting of a pterodactyl, if you will, in and around the Dallas-Fort Worth area. So, you know, you got your pterodactyls, you got, you know, not so many lake monsters. We don't have a lot of lake monsters down in this area, but let's see, what else, DFW? You know, there's Bigfoot sightings for sure, and I cover a lot of those in my Texas Bigfoot book. And this would be a similar case, to where most of those have occurred like prior to 1980 and on back.
Interesting.
To where you have people in and around what was the developing Dallas-Fort Worth on the fringes along the Trinity River Basin and things like that would report quite credible cryptid cool town. Incredible cryptid encounters that you probably wouldn't get today because of the population. But I interviewed a guy who said back in the 1970s, in which would be now Grand Prairie, which is, you know, where almost where Six Flags is,
yep,
along the Trinity River. His dogs had drug up this severed leg up out of the river bottoms, and it was covered in hair, and it looked at a human-like foot. But he said this thing was enormous, and it was covered in hair.
Wow.
So he's like, it looks like a human leg, but it was just, you know, incredibly huge. And he called the police, who responded, and of course, here we have it, a case where they come out and they're like, we don't know what this is. We're going to take this and we're going to let you know. Well, do you think he ever heard back? No.
Yeah. Yeah.
But this was an old rancher, and this guy was straight laced. And he said, I've never really thought about this. I didn't know what it was, because this was some years ago. He said, I was watching Finding Bigfoot, some show about Bigfoot. And he goes, I didn't realize Bigfoots were other places.
Yeah.
I goes, well, maybe what I had was a Bigfoot leg. But, you know, the police took it, and that was the end of it. But I can tell you, this old boy was not just making up something out of the blue. He didn't know what to think of this.
Wow. That is incredible. And yeah, you know, I went to school in the Dallas-Fort Worth area in Irving, and even to see the rampant growth that has happened in that area, up against the river front, everything else. It has expanded rapidly. So yeah, to think that these sightings are still happening near populated areas, I don't think that there are too many, sadly, that area anymore.
It kind of supports the notion, if these creatures are living in the remotest parts, you know, it makes a lot of sense that you just don't. As we move in, every kind of wildlife moves out. I mean, you know, where I live today, right near the Dallas-Fort Worth area, I mean, who's to say a wild cougar hasn't once crossed this section? But they wouldn't now. I mean, although occasionally a wild hog, and we've got coyotes that live not far from us, so they can live in and among us, but sure, I don't think sure. like a Bigfoot creature who...
Yeah, yeah, and I've said that too. Now, granted, I'm a big proponent of, if you are into cryptozoology, if this is something that you should be one of the first people into wildlife habitat. You should be one of the first people being like a Chester Moore out there fighting for habitat to be preserved, that kind of stuff. Because otherwise, yes, eventually we will have, like, you know, the same way that we have bear warnings going on because, you know, we're encroaching on territories with apartment complexes and, you know, cougars roaming through the hills of LA, that kind of stuff. Like, how soon would it be before we see a Sasquatch digging through the garbage can of a local 7-Eleven, you know?
If they survive, that may happen. We're just overlapping their territory. So hopefully we can preserve some wild parts where they can remain.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and it, you know, let's, in the last 10 minutes or so here, Lyle, let's get into what people can do to get involved with research. Cause there are a ton of folks out there that, are out squatching on the weekends. They are out with trail cameras doing more things like that. What can people do, community wise to get involved, to share that data, things like that?
Well, you know, it's a lot easier now to find like-minded individuals if you would like to go researching with, you know, with Facebook and social media, the internet, you know, because it's usually something that's fun to do, at least in pairs or in groups. You know, I don't typically advise going off into the deep woods by yourself just for various safety reasons, not yeah. that Bigfoot or a dog man's going to get you. Maybe they will, but typically, you know, that's, you know, you want to have fun with it, but you also want to be safe out there and, you know, get out into the outdoors. And it's even a good way to get kids out because, you know, if you tell a kid we're going to go, you know, we're going hiking, they're like, ugh. But you tell them we're going Bigfoot hunting in the woods. Oh yeah.
Yeah.
They're all about it. And, you know, so that's something that you can do and involve the whole family, and it's fun whether you see something or not. But, you know, certainly, you know, you can research your own area and probably find sightings. You know, people will often send me a message like, how do I get started? And, you know, what do I do? I said, well, first, just start researching what's in your area. Yeah. It's remotely drivable. You know, I bet you'll find a flap of sightings of Bigfoot or lake monster or something. And that gives you a starting point to where you can, well, if people have seen something there before, perhaps it's a great way to start. Or even to, you know, I'm just such a geek. I just go to places where there's been sightings mm-hmm. and like, oh yeah, it was something weird here. It's like legend tripping. And,
yeah.
So, you know, get out there and have fun. And, you know, I think people need to be discernible about what they post as evidence. You know, I mean, you know, not everything is a Bigfoot out there, and not every yeah. photo has yeah. 15 Bigfoots lurking in the woods. And that's okay. Yeah. I mean,
yep.
This is a treasure to find. This isn't just mundane things you see every day in the woods. Well, so, you know, and if you do find something good or a howl or you do perhaps get a decent picture, then share it and,
yeah,
you know, and be ready for others to pick it apart. But ultimately it's your quest. I mean, yeah. it's, you know, I do this first and foremost because I enjoy it, not because I'm trying to prove to the world anything. I just share the stories and go out and enjoy the outdoors just because I like it.
Yeah. Yeah, precisely. And, you know, for me, it's the fact of if you are out there doing such, you are a citizen scientist at that point. I think people honestly forget the fact that the whole scientific method begins with observation. You know, so as soon as you've had an encounter, as soon as you see something, the science has begun. Like you've already started that process. So, get excited about it and understand that, yes, even if you bring a picture to the table and someone like a Lyle or King Gerhard or, you know, Adam Davies online gives you some ideas of what it may be, in all actuality, that doesn't mean that you still have not contributed to the science. Because understanding what's inside of the red circles is very important. Very, very important. We have to know the known quantitative. If we don't understand the known quantitative fully, then we cannot leave the anomaly to investigate. So be okay with the red circles. Be okay with, you know, when somebody says, I think I have an explanation of what your picture might be. That's okay. You have still contributed to the data set of the science. So that's important to understand.
Yeah. Just, you know, rule out everything that it could be.
Yeah.
And if you're left with something unexplainable, then you're on to something, you know, and that just gives you that target area where you yeah. can continue to return because, you know, I know people have gone out to areas for years upon years and few and far between did they either get a sighting or a photo or anything else, a cast of footprint. But it's about, you know, tenacity and persistence in some cases, because that's how it works with even wildlife photographers. You're going to yeah. go take a picture of a wolverine.
That's right.
You don't just walk up there into Michigan or something and, oh, I'm going to casually get a picture of a wolverine. You got to be out there for weeks. Those things are very elusive and hard yeah. to find.
Yeah.
Those are known. That's a known animal. So,
and you may come back from numerous hunts with absolutely no pictures of a wolverine. You know, And at the same token, if you're out there and you have property, if you are Sasquatch hunting and have trail cameras, things like that, contact your local wildlife department. I'm sure that they would absolutely love the trail camera pictures that they cannot afford to put out, you know, to count local bird populations, to count local bear populations, things like that. What you are throwing away as data may very well help you shake the hands of local science, you know, and once again, help preserve that localized habitat that you're hunting in, that you're actively looking for these critters in. So, you can be doing very important citizen science out there just with the trail camera, that kind of stuff, and actively contributing to great things if you reach out into those communities. So
that's right.
Yeah. Lyle, I want to thank you for your time always. And you especially, you just all of this last year had one of your first experiences where something strange happened. Don't know what it was, but something weird happened while you were out in the swamps near Falk, Arkansas. You've been out there for years, but something happened finally. So yeah, it's the example of keep at it. Keep going, because even though you haven't found it, you haven't found it yet. You know, science is forever ongoing. That's kind of the great part about it, is it's forever evolving. It's forever changing. So, yeah.
All good stuff. It's all about the journey. You know, you got to enjoy the journey, because it's not all about the destination or the catch. You know, enjoy it all. So,
yeah,
I do. And even if we're left with some unexplainable, unsolved mystery, well, that's intriguing unto itself. So it all points to, interesting stories that suggest that, you know, there is things in this world that we may not understand or be able to prove or, you know, see on a consistent basis, but that keeps the world interesting and
yeah,
and curious, if you will.
Absolutely. And you do a great job of conveying those stories, especially with your podcast, the Monstro Bizarro podcast. So, let everybody know a little bit about that, where they can go to tune into that. Let them know where they can go to get their copy of the Lake Worth Monster book, and where they can see you at upcoming shows.
Okay. Yeah. So yeah, I launched a podcast called Monstro Bizarro a couple of years ago that, is a little different format. I just kind of narrate a case and it's different. So check it out. A lot of people haven't been aware that I even have a podcast. It's just sort of in the mix of all the things I do. But if you go to LyleBlackburn.com, you can find info on the podcast and all the books I've written. And my books are available from my web store there, but also, of course, on Amazon in, you know, paperback and ebook. And let's see, I've got a list of dates of where I will be at various events around the country. I travel all over all the time. Doing events, doing speaking presentations, and interacting with people. So, yeah, coming up. And one important thing, I think, to this for the Lake Worth Monster is that there's going to be a Lake Worth Monster Bash out at the Fort Worth Nature Center on October 26th. They only do this about every 5 years. So it's something to catch. It's a little bit of a festival meets symposium where I'll present some of the history and things like that. But there's also fun, family-oriented activities to do out there, a guided hike. And this year will be very special because, as I mentioned, talking to the son of John Reichert, Eric Reichert, Eric is actually going to be at the bash and is going to talk about what his father saw.
Oh, cool.
And as well, Bobby Brooks will be there. And Bobby Brooks was one of the guys there in 1969 that he got a photo of something. And I talk about him in my book, and he actually did the illustration on Sally Ann Clark's Lake Worth Monster book from 1969. So Bobby will be there, and he's a good guy to meet. Craig Woolheater and myself and other speakers, David Weatherly, which is a author on these subjects, Jason McLean, and it'll be a really good, really good monster bash. So check it out. October 26th out there at the Fort Worth Nature Center right there at Lake Worth. And you can stand right there at Greer Island and imagine what you would do if you saw the Lake Worth monster.
If you had this thing whirling tires at you and a crowd of people, Lyle, thank you so much again for your time. It's always great chatting with you. It's always great catching up. Your work is voluminous and amazing. So thank you for everything that you do, and thank you for the time.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
You bet, man. Hold the line real quick while we close things out for this segment. While you are online checking out all of the amazing work of Lyle Blackburn and getting your copy of The Lake Worth Monster, The True Story of the Greer Island Goatman, stop on by Curious Realm. CuriousRealm.com is the website that you want to go to find all of the episodes. That's where you can like, follow, subscribe. Curious Research is where you can go to get your copy of the all new Observation and Encounter Log. If you are a researcher out in the field, stop on by and grab your copy of that so you can get your data ready to shake hands with science. When we come back, folks, from this quick break, we will be chatting with UAP PD, a fantastic movement out of the Arizona area to open the gates for law enforcement officers to be able to report their experiences of not only UAPs, but cryptids and the paranormal. We will be right back with that after this.
The key to good science is good research. At the heart of good research is a good data set. With the Field Observation and Encounter Log from Curious Research, you can easily keep track of your investigative information all in one place, making it easier to review cases and readily see comparisons and contrasts between them. Whether out in the woods squatching, in a back room gathering EVPs, or using high-tech gear to track UFO UAP activity, this easy-to-carry, pocket-sized scientific data log is the perfect companion for any field researcher. You can find your copy of the Curious Research Field Observation and Encounter Log at Amazon.com or visit the official Curious Realm store at CuriousRealm.com/store to reserve your copy for yourself, your family, or a mind that you want to open. That website again is CuriousRealm.com/store.
Hello, everybody, and thank you so much for staying with us through that commercial break. Also, thank you so much to our good friend and guest, Lyle Blackburn. It's always great catching up with him. He does some great, great work in the world of cryptid research, and to have him write that all new book about the Lake Worth monster here on the precipice of the anniversary is awesome. Before we get into our next guest, thank you also to our sponsors, especially True Hemp Science. They are your source for amazing CBD products made through a spigyric process. Every part of the plant is used, seed, stem, roots, every part is used and reused until nothing is left. Stop on by and check it out. TrueHemScience.com is the website that you want to use. Curious7 is the code to save you 7% off your entire cart of $50 or more and get two free edibles on the way out the door. Our guest in this segment is Marianne Robb and Dave Rich. They are, well, UAPPD. They are former former law enforcement officers who are busy working right now trying to bring more awareness to the topic of paranormal in the world of law enforcement and opening channels specifically for law enforcement professionals to be able to report what they see in the field. This is a huge issue going on right now. Welcome back to the show, UAPPD. How are you doing, guys?
Great.
Excellent. Thanks for having us tonight.
Absolutely. I am excited to have you guys on. We had Mary Ann on during our coverage of MUFON this last year, and I am a huge proponent. I know a lot of people in a lot of communities are upset with things like ATIP, things like that. I am a fan because, if anything, what we have done is create a unified system of reporting for people who previously were unable to report things. Pilots who, if they said something, lost their wings, lost a career of 20 plus years, things like that. And you guys are looking to do the same thing in the world of police and law enforcement. How did you guys first come to the world of paranormal investigation, Dave?
Well, for me, Chris, it was an experience that I actually had on the job, where I was working as a SRO at a high school, and we actually had a 911 call come in at a time when school wasn't in session. And the 911 call had a voice that was clear as day, sounded like it said, "I'm scared. Dispatcher is having a conversation with this voice," like an intelligent conversation.
Oh, wow.
It answered a question. Like the voice initially said, "I'm scared." Dispatcher says, "What was that?" And the voice says, "I'm scared" again. Dispatcher says, "You're scared?" And it says, "No." And then you hear the phone get dropped to the countertop. So obviously patrol officers get assigned to the call. They show up, they go inside, search the entire office, and they find nothing. They find the phone off the hook on the counter. Officer picks it up, has a conversation with the dispatcher who's been on this entire time on what we call an open line.
Yeah.
Which is basically if somebody calls 911 and then the phone gets dropped or somebody stops talking and it's just an open line, that dispatcher is going to stay on in an attempt to try and reestablish communications. So the officer finds the phone, has a conversation with that same dispatcher. They search the entire area and they find nothing. Wow. Long story short, my sergeant at the time tells me to do an investigation in this because the officers, while they were searching, they go into the nurse's office and something pushes between the two of them and forces its way out of the office. But there was nothing there. The guy's like, I didn't see anything. All of a sudden, I felt something kind of like hit my shoulder and push by. And the other officer's like, yeah, it hit my shoulder, too, because they walk in together to kind of enter the room. And they saw nothing. So I end up doing this whole investigation, pull the 911 audio, pull the video. The phone in question is right in the center of the video. At the time that 911 call comes in, there's nobody there.
Oh, wow.
And I then see the officers 14 minutes later walk up, pick up the phone, have a conversation. I took this video all the way back to like 6 o'clock in the morning. And there were motion activated sure. lights in that office. And there was three sets of lights, one in front of the desk, one over the desk, one after, like behind the desk. And that phone is right in the center of the screen. And about maybe 20 minutes before the phone call comes in, the lights only over the desk click on, and they're on for like 20 minutes, and then they click back off because there's a 20-minute timer. So, which raises the question of why did the lights on either side not go yeah. off? When that phone call comes in, there is nobody at that phone. And then the other interesting thing is the doorway that leads to the nurse's office. There wasn't a camera in the nurse's office, but you can see the doorway. You can see the two officers walk into the room. So they leave the view. And about 2 seconds later, you see the two of them run out of the room, looking around, like trying to see what just went past them. So we ended up doing this whole investigation, like trying to figure out, was this like a computer generated voice? Was it somebody that hacked the phone lines? Was it, was it a call that came from a classroom? I ruled out every possible lead. And that's the way that most police investigations are done. You're ruling things out. You don't ever decide, hey, this is what the answer is, and then try to support the answer. You try to rule everything out. That's what a thorough investigation is.
Yeah.
I got to the point where I was like, I cannot explain this. And then the interesting part is I took the audio, gave it to a couple of guys from MUFON who had the ability to kind of analyze it a little bit better. Because, of course, the police department got to the point where they're like, hey, yeah, we're not going to pay to analyze this or stuff like that. Yeah, you know, yeah. You ain't got a crime here anymore. But they analyzed the video. And the interesting part was we thought the audio tape said, I'm scared. When we actually amplified it and played it, it actually doesn't say I'm scared. It says I scare.
Oh,
so when the dispatcher says you're scared, it says immediately no, and then drops the phone. And the thing that I think is really like amazing about this audio is a lot of times you'll see investigations and like somebody will ask a question and then the answer is like 3 to 5 minutes later. And they're like, oh, hey, there's the answer to the question that we asked like 3 to 5 minutes ago.
Yeah.
This was literally like, you're scared? No, that quick. It was not like a delay. It was an intelligent conversation.
Yeah.
Between two individuals, it seemed. And so there was a whole other investigation that went into it because I went deeper, but I don't want to bore you with all those details yet. But because the real reason that UAPPD came about was after I did this whole investigation, we're going through all of this stuff. We're kind of coming to the conclusion that this is not something that we can explain. It's not something, you know, I hesitate to say because at the time I was an incredible skeptic. I didn't believe in any of this stuff.
Sure.
But, you know, we're getting to the point like, is this a paranormal encounter? And that was the time that I got called upstairs. And anybody who's in law enforcement understands what that term is when you get called upstairs. That means the people with the stars and the bars and the stripes all want to have a chat with you.
Yeah.
And I get called into an office and I get confronted by a different supervisor who literally told me that I was lying, that I was making up the entire story. He had the video. He had the audio. And still said that I was lying and basically that I am not to talk about this at all. So I obviously had a lot of frustration at that point. I walk out of the office. And as I'm walking back downstairs, I slowly, after the anger kind of subsided, I got to the realization that you need to not say anything, because if you say something, your job's over. And like at this point, I was 19 years into my career.
Yeah.
At 20 years, I could retire. I was trying to do 25. So I'm sitting there thinking to myself, I have 6 years left. I can't give this up. I mean, I've spent my entire life trying to get this job. And so I realized right then and there, you don't talk about this stuff. And so now flash forward about 5.5 years, and I get a phone call from somebody. And another individual that we know by the name of Alejandro Rojas, and the two of them were having this conversation about, you know, there's police officers that are on 24 hours a day. There's always somebody that's working. So they have to be seeing stuff. They have to be encountering things that they can't explain. So why do we only hear about like a very, very small amount of them? Like you've got your Lonnie Zamora, Vale Johnson, got like there are some that are really well known. But if you think about it, just statistically, there have to be more. Why are we not hearing about them? So Marianne kind of brought up the story of mine because she knew about what happened with me.
Yeah.
And so she ends up telling Alejandro, they call me. They're like, well, what's the deal? And I kind of say, well, it's a real simple answer. It's your job. Your job is on the line.
Yeah.
And so that's where the actual seed that became UAPPD came from, because we started realizing I couldn't say anything. So there have got to be other officers that are currently working that are experiencing things that they cannot explain, and they have nowhere to go because our credibility and our anonymity are the two paramount things that we need for our survival as law enforcement officers. And it's not just law enforcement. We're also reaching out to firefighters, EMTs, park rangers, game wardens, anybody who's a first responder who has encountered stuff has this same level of, I don't want to call it threat, but potential hazard that if they encounter something that they can't explain, where do you go? And so that's where we kind of started reaching out to other people that we knew, other officers. We started gathering stories, and it's kind of blossomed into what we're doing now, where we're actively trying to reach out to other members of law enforcement and first responders just to get their stories. And we have officers from all over the spectrum and all over the level of confidentiality that they want, because we always let anybody know, if anybody ever contacts us, you are the one that is in charge of your anonymity.
Yeah.
If you don't want anything known, we will not say anything. If you just want to tell us a story and say, I don't want you to even repeat it to anybody, I just need somebody to get this off my chest to that I can talk to without having to worry about getting in trouble, then we will do that as well. The thing that we want to do, though, is we want to gather as many stories, because our ultimate goal is we want to take that stress that officers and first responders are feeling and give them an out.
Yeah.
And then the best part is some officers are like, you know what? I'm retired now. You can use my name. You can use my picture. I don't care.
Sure.
Go use this to help encourage other officers to come forward and talk. And that's where we are right now.
Well, and you know, quite honestly, you've brought up quite a few issues in one casserole, Dave. And quite when you're talking especially about, A, just the PTSD of a paranormal experience to begin with. You know, all these books that are behind me, things like that, they're written by people who had a very horrible experience that sure led them down a path to something, but that experience changed them in no different a way than every time an officer has to draw their firearm, much less use their firearm. And even whenever they draw their firearm, they're typically put through some kind of step back process psychologically, you know, where it's like, okay, we're going to put you on restrictive duty for a little while. You know, we're going to talk you back through this PTSD of the trauma that you experienced of having to pull a gun on somebody, you know, and threaten their life. Because those are traumatizing things. And if you don't get to talk about them, it can lead to bad, horrible stuff. You know,
that's part of our presentation when we present to people is about those stigmas that we call them, because you're 100% correct. I was, like I said, I was a hardcore skeptic until I had this experience. Now, who do I talk to? Now, in my career, I was 25 years as a police officer. I was a homicide detective. I was a sex crimes detective. I had been on calls where multiple people have been killed. You experience a very, very high level of emotional trauma. This is another form of emotional trauma. Now, when I go to those calls for service that are what we call hot calls, and you're dealing with like a child who has passed away, unfortunately, or something like that, there are mechanisms in place where counselors will come, meet with the officers, meet with the first responders, give them an opportunity to talk and help them start with that healing process. When you encounter something like this, it can be equally as traumatizing because it's something that nobody quite grasps. You spend your entire time going through the academy, going through FTO, doing the job, and nobody ever told you, hey, at some point you're going to walk into a house and see something that you can see right through, and it's going to do something that you can't explain. Or you're going to see a light in the sky that you cannot identify.
Yeah.
Or in some parts of the country, like your previous guest that you were just talking about, you're going to drive down the road and something's going to come out of the woods, and you don't know what that is.
Yeah. Yeah.
Just like somebody who's not a first responder would encounter that level of stressor or trauma that they have, so does a first responder. The extra part of it is we get trained that we're supposed to be able to know all the answers, take care of everything, we're supposed to bring the world back to peace.
Yeah.
And now you're encountering something that you truly cannot explain. So it kind of adds that extra layer of, well, what do I do now?
Yeah.
Sort of thing to the entire equation.
And how do you, you can to an extent, train somebody for when they have to pull a firearm, things like that. You can do a lot of instinctual training. And fortunately there is a lot of really good, psychiatric training going on with officers in the field now. There's, been a huge movement, especially since the good couple of cops in San Antonio started the efforts to, dealing with the psychological needs of homeless people, things like that, that you confront in the street on a regular basis, where let's get them some help instead of putting them through the system. And it's great. It's awesome to see those kinds of things happening. And even all of a couple weeks ago, there was the release of by a group of police chiefs of a UAP response guidebook that just apparently hit PDFs in police forces around the country. So it's interesting to see these topics being broached in mainstream media. It's interesting to see local PDs, and apparently enough that a group of sheriffs was like, hey, we need to have a protocol for this. Like, if this is happening and experiences are happening, we need to, how are our guys going to respond to it when it happens? You know?
And it comes down to exactly like what you're saying is we get trained on how to respond to a burglary. We get trained in how to respond to a car accident or a missing child or something like that. There's no training for this. Right now, there's not.
Yeah.
Now, the guidebook that they just brought out, that's just barely scratching the surface.
Yes.
The reality is we are getting calls like this. We're sending first responders out to handle them, but they really don't have any type of training of like, well, what do I do? Like, say I go out because I get a call because somebody calls up because they see lights in the sky and they don't know what it is. And they think it's some sort of UFO or some sort of UAP or a craft. And what happens if the officer goes out there and he looks up in the sky and there's something there? It's like, now what do you do? Because you don't have like a group to call or something to do. Not, you know, you don't really know exactly how to respond.
Yeah.
So what we do is we handle it the best we can with use it like an unknown trouble type call or, you know, some sort of like disturbance, an unknown disturbance call. But again, you're just kind of trying to fit a square peg through a round hole.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, let's turn things toward investigation. Because of course, as police officers, you guys have been put through fantastic, beautiful rigors in training on how to handle a crime scene, everything from beat cop to detective, at least knows some protocol of what to do when you come across it. You know, at least I would hope so. Is that correct?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah,
depending on what it is. Yeah,
I mean, hopefully you don't have the rookie just like, you know, walking through with the jelly donut, getting evidence all over his footprints or footprints all over the evidence, rather. But how do you apply the world of criminal investigation with law enforcement to paranormal investigation, an investigation of UFO, UAP, even cryptid? Stuff like that. Marianne?
Basically, we would just use our training as a law enforcement officer. We would just treat that as a, like Dave was saying, an unknown trouble call. You know, say a Bigfoot. It would be okay. We'll call it a unknown person, maybe a trespasser, a prowler. You know, we'll look at it that way. Okay, how would we do the investigation on a prowler call or a trespasser call? In a way, we would still follow all of the procedures that we need to do until we come to that point where it's like, okay, it's not a human. We don't know what exactly it is. We would, you know, get the footprints. We would take photos. We would talk to witnesses. We would do everything we could until we to the point where we're like, okay, this is way out of our scope of law enforcement. This is definitely something that is an unknown. And a lot of officers would have no clue if you said a cryptid. They would have absolutely no idea what that is.
But and that's the thing is like at its core, as a first responder, our job is to respond to the calls that the public have put forth saying, we've encountered something we don't know. Our job is to go there and address it. Mm-hmm. And even if it's something that we don't understand, every officer, I don't care if it's a dude right out of the academy or somebody who's been there for 25 years, they're going to show up and they're going to do their best. They're going to figure out what they can do and try to ultimately put this person, the citizen, at ease. Because even if we don't have the answer, we still have to resolve the problem. And the problem isn't necessarily what they're seeing. It's a combination of what is that, but also the fact that it's affected this person. So what we need to do is, at the very least, we have to help this person who called 911 who said, I am seeing something that I don't know. I don't feel safe. We need to make them feel safe. How do we go about doing that? Well, it kind of depends on what we encounter and how we can go through it. Because sometimes, and this is with every investigation, this may not even be something paranormal. This could be just a regular investigation. Every investigation has turns. I hate to say it, because like you watch TV and you watch like Law and Order and all these things. And, oh, there's this twist and this turn. There's a little bit of truth to that. I mean, most of those shows, it's just entertainment. But in some investigations, you do get some turns and some twists. And sometimes you're left at that point where you're like, the best I can do is help this person feel good. And then I'm going to look at this and go, I don't know what it is. I'm going to gather whatever evidence I can and log it in somewhere and just be like, hey, now it's time to go to the next barking dog call.
One of the things that you just showed, Chris, on your site was the Las Vegas. Uh-huh. Let's go ahead and get that out in the open now.
Please.
Those officers did a really good job.
They did.
I looked at the body cam. But they are to the point where it's true. First of all, the first body cam capture that they had was a meteorite.
Yep.
It was a meteor. That's an awesome, awesome catch.
Yeah.
I mean, that's like a one in a million catches on that. But yes, we know for a fact that's a meteor. Now, these folks calling and saying there's somebody in the backyard. It could be an alien. We don't know. The officers, you could even see in the body cams, they're like, okay, what were they doing? They were trying to put the people at ease. Just like Dave said, number one priority, tell the people, hey, we're here. We're going to help you out. We'll do what we can. But when you look at the officer looking to the other officer, they're dumbfounded. They don't know where to go. And now on this case here, we were told by an investigator in Las Vegas, not a police officer, we've already been told, don't talk to any officers. You know, it's over. It's done with. It would not be a good thing for us to even try to go contact an officer.
Yeah.
Which I'm hoping maybe off duty, they'll talk to us, because officer to officer kind of thing. But we've been told by an investigator that they tried their darndest to contact these folks three different times and nobody's calling them back.
Wow.
So overall, it's probably a hoax.
Yeah.
However, with the officers, the dumb look on their face, like, what do we do? What do we do? Oh, my gosh. I mean, they're being so professional.
Oh, absolutely.
I applaud them for that.
Yeah.
I'm not laughing at these folks.
Yeah.
But where does the officers go? Now, that guidebook, it's little tiny bit of information. There really isn't a lot, except on page 10 saying, you know, talk about MUFON, the National UFO Reporting Center, which is okay. But we need more in depth. But you know what? It's the first foot forward with this chiefs of police. I think it was called Midwest Chiefs of Police. It would be great that we get another guide out there with the International Associations of Chief of Police, which is just, you know, even more cities.
Yes.
And states. But it's a baby step, which is great. If these folks are okay with this guide book that came out, great. Let's go higher. How do officers actually, what questions to ask?
Yeah.
You know, what procedures to go and who to contact?
Yep.
And that'll be, I think, the next step. But like I said, Vegas, I was very impressed. Those poor guys didn't know what to do.
Yeah. And that's just it. How do you handle that? Because number one, the one thing that I loved about this article from Police One was the highlight at the very end. Their reports are taken seriously. How to make sure that police know that when they report something like that, or when a report like that comes in, how does the victim know that they're going to be taken seriously when they call the police to report something? B, how do the police know that they're going to be taken seriously when they back up what somebody said that they saw? You know? And that's a huge point to know that, you know, your report, even as an officer of the law, that it will be taken into consideration and highly looked at.
But the biggest thing is they were great, and they probably knew in the back of their mind that when I go back to that department, I'm going to be ridiculed to no end. Just unfortunately, I'm going to throw him under the bus, just like he did when he did his investigation of the 911 call. And they knew that Dave was with Phoenix MUFON and everything else. Oh, he had the bumper stickers on his locker. He had the tinfoil hats. He got ridiculed by his own guys when he did this investigation. So, you know, the Vegas guys, even though they were so perfect at on the street, they knew, oh, my gosh, I can't wait till I get back. What's going to happen in briefing tomorrow morning or what's going to happen? And that's the bad thing of, well, in Vegas, they wouldn't, basically the assistant chiefs shut everything down, says, nope, not talking about it anymore. We're done. And I bet they got a lot of ridicule, kind of like what happened to Lonnie Zamora. You know, he, his investigation, everything. And then what happened? I mean, his life just went to pot after that. And I think that's what happened to maybe the Vegas guys. I'd like to really talk to them just, you know, one-on-one.
See, and that's one of the things is, like Marianne mentioned, Lonnie Zamora. There was Jim Blackwood up in the Royal Canadian Mounted Police. There have been a number of officers who have experienced stuff. And everybody always talks about what they saw, what they saw, what they saw. Nobody ever decided to look, hey, what happened to them after the incident?
Yeah.
That's kind of where we started looking because of what's going on. And it's sad. Like, you look at, like, Lonnie Zamora's career after he saw that sighting. Jim Blackwood, he literally came out and said, this was the worst mistake I ever made. Mm. Like, the fallout is something that nobody truly comprehends.
Yeah.
Even at the time when you see it. I think at the time when you're experiencing it, the officers are kind of like, just like everyone else, are kind of like shocked. Like, holy cow, what is this that I'm experiencing?
Yeah.
And they say things. And then it isn't until a couple days later that they start realizing, oh, you know what? I shouldn't be talking about this because people are going to say things and think things. And where is this going to go? And then they start getting the ridicule. And then everybody starts going, you know, I'm just not going to say anything. And then other officers are seeing what these guys are seeing what they're going through. And then when they have their own encounter, they're like, yeah, I'm not saying nothing because I saw what happened.
Yeah.
When somebody actually said what they saw.
Yeah, yeah, and that's just it. It makes it a see something, do nothing situation. And that, good Lord, that's the last thing you want with anybody, much less first responders, you know? And it creates I can see how, especially within ranks, it could create a huge, huge cloud of mistrust amongst people. You know, and, you know, let's rewind a minute, Dave, because you said when you had your experience, when your experience first happened to you, everything that caused UAPPD to start, that you were a skeptic. How much of that skepticism do you still maintain?
I am definitely open to the idea that there is stuff out there that we don't understand. Since we've started UAPPD, I've been gathering other stories with other officers.
Sure.
We've even gone out and done some investigations. And I used to always be really good at coming up with, like, if you see something, you go, oh, that was clearly this. Maybe you're right, maybe not. But you were able to kind of convince yourself that was probably what the answer was. Mm. Since we've kind of, like, ventured into this world, I'm definitely running across things that I never thought I would encounter, and it has become increasingly more difficult to try and bluff myself into thinking it was something normal. So I'd say I believe that there's a lot more out there than I think I know. And I think there's a lot more out there than a lot of people know.
Okay.
And it's a matter of people kind of, and I hate to say this because it's almost like until you experience it yourself, there's always that kind of nagging doubt in the back of your mind.
Sure.
Until you get confronted with that true eye-opening moment where you're like, I cannot explain this. Hmm. Then doors start opening a little bit, like things get cracked open a little bit, and you start going, maybe there's something to that Drake equation. Maybe there's something to, you know, what the guy saw walking down the street past the cemetery at night. And so I am going to call myself not a skeptic anymore, but a willing skeptic.
Okay.
I'm willing to believe.
Okay.
But I still want more I don't go into it, you know, blindly.
Sure.
I want to hear the facts. I want to hear, and that's what I think every good investigator should be. I think every good investigator should have a level of skepticism, because you don't want to believe everything that somebody tells you.
Yeah.
But you want to be willing to believe when you get to that point where you're like, I think this is something I can't explain.
Yeah. Yeah, no, exactly. Exactly. And, you know, being ready to accept the evidence prima facie for what it is, without having to, like, we don't have to put it through excruciating detail if we can pretty much off the cuff tell you what it is. But at the same time, having enough Magellan in you to keep going, when things get weird, you know, and when things may not necessarily point to a typical solution.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Yeah, I can see how that's necessary. Now, with that in mind, let's start getting into investigation and how you treat an investigation, as from the point of take-in, process, through gathering data, all that kind of stuff.
Well, I think the majority of the time, when we do like a UAP investigation, UAPPD investigation, we handle it the same way we handled like any criminal investigation. The first thing you're going to want to do is kind of assess the situation, gather what background information you can get. So you're starting with that information gathering situation. Talk to witnesses, get a look of the location, kind of, you know, do a survey at the beginning, because you always want to get that big picture and then you always want to shrink it in. It's just like when you're gathering evidence. You don't want to start with a little small area. You got to start big and work your way in, so that way you're not missing things. You're not trampling over your own evidence like you talked about earlier.
Sure.
So all of our investigations, when we do them, we start with that big picture, gathering the statement from the witnesses. Because the reality is most of our investigations, we're not going to know about until somebody calls up and says, hey, by the way, I had this happen. And so we start by gathering those stories and getting a statement from them and saying, okay, talk us through what happened. Gather it up. Marianne was a detective for a period of time. I was as well. We use those same skills. I actually spent a good chunk of my career as a homicide and sex crimes detective. So I use the same skills that I did when I was talking to victims of a sexually based offense or a violent physical offense that I used then. I use those same skills when I'm talking to people now who've experienced something, because it's still a level of trauma. It's just a different level of trauma, but it's still at its core a level of trauma.
Yeah.
So like I'm basic and advanced forensic interviewer. So I have those skills that I use on the job, I use in these. Once we get our good story done, now it's time to actually get out into the field and get out to where it is, get a good eyes on it, see is there any physical evidence, whether it's something that happened to the person that they have, I found this thing when I was out there or whatever it was, and then go out to the scene and see if we can gather anything. And we work it the same way that we would work any criminal investigation, whether it was a stolen car or a shoplifting or a burglary at a house. So, and I think that kind of is slightly different than most paranormal investigators, because most people, when they investigate, like if you're told, hey, I'm going to investigate a ghost at a house.
Yeah.
You're going to go in there thinking I'm going to investigate a ghost at a house. So you're kind of too focused right from the start that you're looking for a ghost at a house. In law enforcement, you have to start big picture, rule out all the stuff that you have to, and narrow it down. And so we kind of approach all of our investigations that same way, where we want to start big and say, hey, it's a light in the sky. Well, hey, it's a light in the sky. We're investigating a light in the sky. Let's start ruling stuff out. Are there crop dusters? Was it an airplane? Were there Chinese lanterns? Was there an astronomical, you know, an astrological body that was up in the sky that was visible from the earth? And we do it that way, because we kind of rule everything out until we get to the point where now I have no idea what the heck it is. I have to accept that it's not any of these mundane things that we have already ruled out.
Yeah.
And then we venture down the road of, because one of the things that we do is we never come right out and say it's a ghost or it's Bigfoot or those are aliens, because we truly can't verify that it is a ghost or a Bigfoot or aliens.
Yeah.
But what we can do is we can say, well, it wasn't an airplane. It wasn't a bear. It wasn't headlights from a truck driving past a house.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so that's how we kind of handle all of our investigations.
And that is hugely important, massively important. You know, that is one of the things that we bring up on the show regularly when it comes to, I mean, once you're talking about paranormal to begin with, it widens the scope of investigation massively, to the point of disinterest for a lot of science, you know, because it crosses too many barriers and you can't, really get to something. However, the way you're talking about is the same way we talk about on the show. And it's the idea of you've got to get rid of the known quantitatives, you know, to a prime example would be the image I am popping up on screen right now. This is a still image. I'll make it move. This is an image that I captured in my backyard. Now, granted, if I gave you nothing other than, hey, I recorded this video in my backyard and posted it up with just that data, you could get 100 different responses on social media from that. If I actively gave you more data and said, you know, I recorded this video in my backyard at 8:15 p.m. I was facing southwest. You know, the object was approximately this high off of the horizon, things like that. You could probably very easily deduce the fact that that is the Dog Star Sirius out of focus in my telescope. The only reason it's moving is because the Earth is rotating. And that is the exaggeration of the Earth's rotation through my telescope. But that's a prime example of, given just a small amount of data, it's very hard to get a very good picture. And you know, the problem frequently is the fact of we need the 1,000 words to go with the picture.
Yes.
We need the 1,000 words. You know, the picture is only good for the people that were there when the picture was taken. Even a picture of a wedding is fantastic, but it means 85 times more to the people in that picture than to somebody just casually looking at it and going, ooh, a wedding.
And that's why investigations are so important, to take that big picture, because you have to get exactly like what you're saying. You have to get all of the available data to draw your conclusion.
And we also have other members of our team. Mark D'Antonio, the chief photo video analyst for MUFON. Yep. He's on our team.
Awesome.
Dennis Fearmuth, who is the chief investigator with Phoenix MUFON. He's retired, but he's still doing all the photo and video analysis for us. So on something like that,
yeah,
I would have no clue myself. And I would take that because I will do a thorough investigation up to that point, and then I give it to the experts. Okay, guys, explain what is this object that we're seeing on this video?
Yeah,
because that's definitely not my forte. You know, I could do a great investigation or an interview. I let them do that. So we have those guys on our team when we do get a video or a photo or maybe somebody's body cam and we go, hey, guys, can you look at this? What do you think? And that's like the Las Vegas with the meteor.
Yeah.
Mark just knew right away. Yep. That's a meteor they caught on their body cam.
Oh, yeah.
That night.
Yeah. Say, as soon as I saw it, it was like nice bolide. that is incredible. Nice copper meteorite coming straight through the sky. I'd still love to be the person that finds the actual meteorite, because I bet it's a nice one.
Cool.
it is important, though, the way that you treat your examination of data once you've begun an investigative process on something. How do you go about, I guess, curating that data as things come into you? How do you go about vetting things? That kind of stuff.
Well, we're dealing with law enforcement and first responders. So we're dealing with these guys that I'm not going to say they're not going to try to hoax us. So we're putting it as these are trained observers. These are investigators. They're not going to put their career on the line to give us some hoax just for kicks and grins. So we believe it is good information, a good investigation. And at that point, again, also, we also teach advanced interviewing techniques. We do it at the MUFON Symposium. We do it also with the MUFON Boot Camp we have here in the Phoenix area in November. So that's what we're looking at. When we do an interview, even with a law enforcement or a first responder, we're going to look at their body language. How are they telling us the story? What are they, and also, what words are they using to tell us the story? Are they trying to hoax us? So we're hoping that's never going to happen, but we're always looking for it. So we start that interview. We whatever information, prime example, we have Gila River or the Indian Reservation law enforcement officers. Mm. They have a lot of paranormal stuff happen on the reservation. They came, we had a couple of guys come to my house. We did a Zoom interview with them. Again, we did look at the body language. We did look at the way they were talking to us to see deception, not deception. Sure. But then what we did is we actually went out to the area on the Indian reservation, and we had video cameras. And we sat there from daylight all the way until dark, looking and videotaping this entire area. And just to put a little tidbit out there is we caught something on that.
Oh,
that's
wow.
all I'm going to say about that one. But we actually did catch something in that area that they say happens. So, I mean, it's amazing, but it did happen to us.
Interesting. Interesting. Now, with that in mind, because, of course, y'all are in Arizona and there are a few reservations out there. But do y'all have y'all noticed an uptick of reports coming from reservations from law enforcement officials? Do y'all find more cooperation from those guys than from your standard city sheriff?
Yeah. And it's funny because the same guys that we talked to that Marianne was just talking about that led us to kind of doing an investigation out there. When we kind of talk, because when we talk to these officers, it's not like we're just like, hey, dude, hey, come here, tell us the story and then get out the door. They're like brothers and sisters in arms. So we have them over to the house and we hang out with them for a little bit. We're talking to them about like different stuff. Like, hey, what did you like about the job? What did you dislike? What do you, you know, try to get to know them and try and get them comfortable to come up and talk to us. Cause again, traumatic incident. So when we were talking with two of the guys from the one Indian reservation, we kind of talked about the stigmas that officers face. Both of these guys had only been officers on the reservation. And the one looked at me and was like, what are you talking about? Like, what do you mean? Like, you can't talk about this stuff? And we're like, no. Like, we, no. Like, they yell at us and tell us no.
Yeah.
And they were, like, shocked because they're like, this is, like, we talk about this stuff all the time. And it comes back to the community. Like, all law enforcement is a reflection of the community that they're in.
Sure.
The officers at a reservation are a reflection of the Native American community that's there. This is part of their culture, like star people and spirits and different types of entities. And it's dark outside, so I'm not going to say because I know from them that you shouldn't say words like that.
That's right.
So, but that is like looking at anybody from that community, not everybody has experienced it. But it's more normal for them. So it's like looking at somebody and saying, hey, a payphone. Hey, I saw a payphone. And like people are like, well, yeah, I know they existed, but like you can't really find them anymore. But yeah, I know they're real. It's like the same thing. Like they're on the res saying, hey, I had an encounter with a little person. And they're like, oh, yeah, my uncle had an encounter with little people and stuff like that. So there's not really that level of stigma because the community believes the same thing that the officers believe. So when they're talking about it, they can talk about it without any real problem. And that was kind of shocking to those officers when we kind of explained like, no, man, you don't talk about stuff like that. Like in the locker room, in the briefing room, you don't bring that up. And so we have noticed that because we've gotten quite a bit of a lot of our stories have come from reservation officers. And we have a lot from non-res officers. But you can see the difference and almost even like the willingness to talk because they, again, it's what is to them like, this, you know, hey, it's Tuesday. Yeah. To versus a different guy who's like, oh gosh, I'd never talk about that.
Yeah, and that was something that we brought up whenever we spoke with Thiago Tietchi, who is, as far as I know right now, still the sole investigator for MUFON in Brazil. Mm-hmm. One of the most populous places in the world for UFO sightings, and they have an investigator. But I asked him, like, you know, how frequently, cause occasionally he'll get reports from people that were like out on oil rigs in the jungle or something like that. And I was like, how often, whenever you're out there taking a report, something like that, do you hear from locals? And he was like, pretty rarely we hear from locals because for them, it's nothing strange.
Yeah.
He was like, it's been happening to them for generations out there in the jungle. So they don't, it's nothing odd for them to be like, hey, that was really weird. We should tell somebody. Like, that's a typical Wednesday night for them, mm-hmm. you know? So yeah, it's interesting to see how that translates and how even the world of cooperation, I guess, almost interdepartmentally, you could say, and the willingness once again to share experience, how much of a difference that community support really makes.
Yeah.
So, with our last few minutes, what can people do, as far as their involvement with other programs like UAPPD? Are there other programs like UAPPD out there? How can investigators in other areas team up with their local law enforcement to start programs like UAPPD? Are you guys looking to expand in other areas? Or?
Actually, not really. If anybody wants to talk to us, even if they just want to share a story they have, and they can remain absolutely anonymous or they can identify themselves. But if they would love for us, we are looking to write a book. So we would love to get stories from officers and first responders to be part of the book. But even if they just want to talk to us, just to get it out of their system, kind of like Dave, he stressed for over 6 years with what happened to him and it hurt his health, his family life, his career.
Yeah.
And we know there's law enforcement officers out there that this happening to. Please get with us. We would work with other officers in other departments. If they would like to just help us, we'll give them some cards and they can pass them out to their other, their fellow officers that have issues, that have stories or encounters that they would like to talk to us. But we're not looking to expand our organization right now.
Not yet.
We're just here, but we would love to have, if any other officers around the country that are willing to help us by talking to officers and just have our card to hand out, that would be great. You've been putting our website up, which is great. I appreciate it. We also do have a Facebook, which is UAP-PD, is our Facebook. And also we do have, my Gmail account. I don't have it if it's on there, but if anybody wants to contact me personally, not going through, say, our website, it's UAPPolice@gmail.com. So it's UAP, another P for police at gmail.com.
Okay.
Now, unfortunately, Dave works full time still. I am retired. So if there's any law enforcement or first responders that would like to share their stories with us, but don't want to do it over the phone, don't want to do it Zoom, they want us to come to them, I would be more than happy to grab a plane ticket real quick and go, or drive wherever I need to go to get, you know, meet with them and to get their story. I have no problem traveling wherever I need to. So if nothing else, they get to know us. Instead of doing this on the phone or on Zoom, they get to see us in person and get to meet us and build a good rapport that way.
Yeah. Yeah. And that is essential, especially when you're talking about traumas, when you're talking about, you know, situations of extreme trust, you know, because once again, all too frequently, sadly, careers rely on this, you know, and it's the fact of many times police won't report things that they see because not just the fear of ridicule, but the fear of it being used against them in court. You know, I mean, a good yep. defense lawyer could eviscerate you with that.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and absolutely call into question your accountability, your credibility as a police officer, all kinds of things. So, yeah. Yeah, I can see how it would be very hard for people that are first responders or that wear the badge to come forward with that. So thank you guys so much for everything that y'all are doing to help clear that pathway. Anything else that y'all would like to say before we let you go? Any other messages for those out there who may have had an experience or maybe going through this right now that wear a badge or a first responder?
Day? So, yeah, real quick. If you are somebody you know is in law enforcement, fire, EMT, first responders, and you've encountered something that you cannot explain, trust me, you are not alone. I was right there with you. We are willing to talk. We are willing to give you an outlet, a vent. We don't judge. Like I said, I've seen stuff now that I cannot explain. And we just want to provide an opportunity for you to talk. You can be completely anonymous. You can tell us whatever you want to, like, level of identifier as you want. But please reach out. Let us know. We would love to hear your story. We would love to at least be a sounding board for you to get it off. And if you need assistance some way, we can help get you some. Yeah. We can help make arrangements. We've in the process of doing this, we've encountered a lot of people who are willing to help. But the problem wasn't quite known. So please, Facebook, email, we have a website as well. Reach out to us in one of those means, and we're more than willing to help you.
Fantastic. Guys, thank you so much for the time. I greatly appreciate it. I cannot tell you how excited I am for this endeavor to be out there. I think it is probably one of the most important things that the paranormal and UAP community could do. So absolutely imperative. Thank you guys for your work. I look forward to y'all coming on many, many times in the future. So
absolutely. Thank you, Chris. We appreciate being on with you.
Absolutely. Hold the line real quick while we close things out. While you are online checking out everything from UAPPD, everybody, make sure to stop on by Curious Realm. CuriousRealm.com is where you can like, follow, subscribe, share. That's where you can find all the episodes. That is where you can get your copy of the all new Curious Research Field Observation and Encounter Log. If you are an investigator of the paranormal, stop on by and check that out. Get your copy so you can get your data ready to shake the hands of science. Thank you so much, everybody, as always, for your time, for your open hearts, your open minds, for the conversation. Without our open hearts and our open minds, the conversation doesn't happen. And without the conversation, humanity does not move forward. So remember, take care of yourselves, take care of each other, and stay curious. We'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Thank you for tuning in to this episode of The Curious Realm. Stay tuned for more guests, forbidden topics, and hidden truths. Follow us on social media by searching Curious Realm. To download the official Curious Realm app and view the Knowledge Vault, or become a sponsor of Curious Realm, visit our website at CuriousRealm.com. Curious Realm is available on your favorite podcast and video services, CuriousRealm.com, as well as KGRA Radio, APR TV, and the official Curious Realm app for Roku devices. Curious Realm is a proud member of the Ground Zero Media and Aftermath Media family of podcasts. For more great shows and members-only content, visit aftermath.media today. Thanks for listening. Stay curious, and remember, the other side is always watching.